Working Cows Podcast, Episode 81.
Welcome to the podcast that gives producers a platform to discuss and share paradigm-challenging practices. Practices that have increased the effectiveness of their operation and the joy that their families have received from this lifestyle.
Well, last week on the main episode that I released, I closed with a plea for someone to start a sheep podcast because there is obvious demand for it and obvious forward-thinking people in the sheep industry. And Dave Ola is a multiple-time guest to the Working Cows podcast, and I think you recognize his value, and I'm glad to have him back on. We're going to talk about the history of sheep in the Western United States specifically today and kind of how they came to be here and some of the challenges that they face. So, Dave, thank you for joining me today on the Working Cows podcast.
Happy to be here, Clay. Thanks for having me.
So, I know that you have a presentation coming up in the near future on the history of the sheep industry. Could you just share with us a little bit about some of the things, the ideas you're going to be presenting there?
Well, sure. South Dakota has a long history in the sheep industry, and I'll be presenting at the Journey Museum 1st of March about sheep industry in South Dakota and just some, you know, facts, current facts. South Dakota ranks about 5th in all sheep and lamb and wool production in the United States. People don't think about that. South Dakota, very unique in its geography in that we have the Missouri River dividing us, and so we have intensive farming on the east side of the state and a lot of rangelands on the west side of the state, but darned if sheep don't fit in both of those schemes, and they fit very well and allows South Dakota to have some unique opportunities and advantages that other states don't have. Our biggest strength is that South Dakota possesses the infrastructure that a lot of our neighboring states don't have to support the industry. And when you start thinking about those other pieces of production that's needed for livestock producers to be viable, which would include veterinarians that understand sheep, loan officers that understand the value and how a sheep cash flow is going to work, the feed experts and nutritionists and the feed stores that are willing to handle sheep products, those things all become deal breakers. The other things that we have that we take for granted that other states don't have so accessible is we have a whole host of sheep shearers, which becomes an important part of our industry because of the need to shear the wool off and the value of the wool, and we have wool warehouses and wool experts that can find value in that wool. And this year, again, we're looking at those fine wool ewes having a $35 fleece on their backs, which becomes pretty significant. If you take that times 5 or 6 to equal one cow, you're looking at $150 to $180 of just wool. And it costs about $5 to get the wool off, so that becomes a pretty good paycheck. Sale barns, livestock marketing opportunities for sheep. And then, who buys those lambs? And those are feedlots or feeders. And eastern South Dakota and in the I-29 corridor, Minnesota and Iowa are full of lamb feedlots over there that really support our industry, as well as we're not that far from Weld County, Colorado, which has a lot of lamb feeding facilities as well as the packing plants in good proximity there. So South Dakota, in its geographic location and what we have for infrastructure, is prime sheep-producing country. How did it get there? Well, as with all the settlement of the Great Plains, you think about what is the one thing that impacted and drove and caused lots of issues in settlement, and that was water. And what is it out in southeast Montana in western South Dakota and Wyoming that we lack is water. We're semi-arid to almost desert at some times, some spells. And we don't have a lot of live streams that are flowing in a larger network that we can access. And so that being the case, a lot of the water that is out there is not of the best quality. And sheep, being a desert animal, fit that landscape much better. As we develop water, our grasses in the northern plains are some of the best grasses in the world for their nutritional density and their ability to carry that and hold that nutrient content year-round. And so as we've developed water, we've provided that opportunity to put cattle in places on the northern plains that they would not have otherwise been because of the lack of water.
So what are some of the challenges that you've talked about a lot of the advantages? What are some of the challenges that western South Dakota and the regions like it, similar to it, present for sheep production?
Well, I'm going to say this jokingly because I've lived through them all. And the one thing that the Northern Plains does is minimizes its human population because of the weather. And that's the same thing with livestock. We've had some livestock-killing blizzards that have really taken a toll over the since settlement in how they've impacted livestock numbers. And sheep in this cold weather with the full fleece on do great. There is very little impact to them. They can be out on the prairies grazing. And again, sedges out there carrying 10 to 12% protein, they can access them this time of year and would need very little supplement as compared to a cow. However, when you get those blizzards that blow in with 2 feet of snow and 60 to 70 mile an hour winds for 2 to 3 days, you're looking at that sheep hitting its limit in its ability to survive that. And they just move with the wind like cattle do, and they'll get trapped in fence corners or fall into draws or off creeks and ravines and then snow under. And that's been a fact that sheep producers have lived with since the settlement of this part of the country. And so when those blizzards come in, the sheep producers really, really take that seriously and try to get those sheep into cover.
So how did sheep end up in western South Dakota? How did they get here?
Well, a couple different directions. Again, looking at both sides of the state, you have a farmer, farm flock production systems moving in to eastern South Dakota. And the nice thing about sheep as opposed to cattle, again, they can do well on more undesirable forages. So in your poorer ground, you could graze them and then farm your better ground. Likewise, because of the size of the animal, it does not take much to set up corrals and handling facilities for sheep as compared to cattle as far as, you know, their ability to withstand the pressures. So you saw a lot of that come in. Railroads provided that infrastructure needed to ship those lambs back to Chicago and Minneapolis and some of those packing areas. That was huge. I can even remember my granddad shipping lambs out of Newell on railroad cars to Huron. At that time, there was a packing plant there and went east. So some of that infrastructure was there. And western South Dakota, sheep actually came from the west. And if you ever read some of your history books, they tended to make a big circle, and it was based on gold rushes. So you look at the California gold rush, they moved in hundreds of thousands of more sheep in the California. Obviously, the vaqueros had cattle and sheep there before European or American settlers moved over that way. But as you increase those populations And again, thinking about a lot of California being desert, they trailed sheep out of Texas and New Mexico to supply food for the miners and all the inhabitants. And then you just start making a circle up to Oregon, and then they had gold strikes in Idaho and Montana, Virginia City, and come around that way and then into the Black Hills. And so the Western Range Jews moved in a lot of respects, coming out of those parts of the country, Idaho, Utah, Western Wyoming, and Montana.
What was the form of those sheep when they came in? Were they similar to the sheep we have today? Were they bigger, smaller?
Very smaller. In a lot of respects, the Western Range ewes were primarily made up of and had a lot of influences more into the late 1800s of the Rambouillet breeds. As a lot of them come out of Texas and New Mexico, Arizona, you would have a lot of the Navajo sheep influences there. But as you start thinking of the textile fibers that were available in the late 1800s, well, in the 1800s period, cotton and wool. And so many of those sheep and a lot of producers in the northern plains, the lambs weren't the valued commodity. It was the wool that really provided the profit because, like I said, these guys were running these ewes out on these prairies year-round with little or no supplement and then harvesting that wool once a year. So they had very little into them and so much open range out here. To the point that, as with all the stories of history goes with ranching at that time, both cattle and sheep, they overgrazed the prairies horribly.
So that brings me to the question of the strategy, the historical strategy of raising sheep, and how is it different than it was today than it was then? I'm assuming they were raising sheep with less overheads or less infrastructure then than we are now. A lot of the places I'm aware of lamb through a shed and shoot for that 180 to 200% lamb crop. How does it differ today than it did then?
Well, in early 1900s and during the settlement of this side of the state, again, no fencing existed, and a lot of fencing didn't really occur till up into the 50s, so it was very open range. And so how do you identify your ranch or your entitlement is by rocks and what have you, but with no fences, they had the need for sheep herders. And so every ranch would have a set of herders, and they would outfit them with many times what you would call the traditional sheep wagon, but they had line cabins and other modes of camping out there. And then you had on your ranch, your foreman or your camp tender that would circle around and supply all those herders. And those herders knew what area they were supposed to be grazing in, and ideally, and what a great opportunity, they could move those sheep to fresh grass every day. And then they would trail them 2 to 3 miles, if not more sometimes, to a water source. And all the different herders would utilize those that same water source, so you had to take your turn at bringing your sheep to that area. An interesting note out here east of Newell, where I am, on the old, what we call the old Fairpoint Road, or old 212 that goes straight east of Newell, the railroad put in, every 10 miles, they put in a trailing stock dam. So as you trailed your both cattle or sheep into Newell, you would go 10 miles, 12 miles a day, and then you would camp at a dam and bring them in. Those dams still exist out there along that road. And that road's easement is a lot wider than the other county roads around just for that trailing aspect.
So were they lambing at a different time of year then in those situations?
Yeah, certainly in the range operations, we're doing a more of a May-June lambing out on the open prairies. worked well most times unless you've got into a rainy monsoon type of year, which would cause a lot of issues then, because what you have to think about is body mass on lambs. A lamb born now is 8 to 9 pounds, and it doesn't take a lot for them to chill down as compared to a calf that's, say, 80, 85 pounds. There's a lot more body mass before they actually succumb to hypothermia. So, yes, a lot of prairie lambing as people started fencing areas off and knew that there's that opportunity to get more than just one lamb and improve their lambing percentages by management and labor was more readily available at that time. They would start running them through shed lambing scenarios. A lot of which were still in the later springs just because of the weather and the feed resources. You know, as we became more mechanized and were able to put up more hay and transport more corn in, then folks moved their lambings earlier into the winters for a number of reasons, some of which have to do with trying to hit early markets, the early markets for lambs, rather than being in the general run. Some of it has to do with seed stock, and some has to do with labor availability at the time.
What other influences, what kind of sheep were they running? What breeds of sheep were they running early on in this part of the country?
Well, again, as wool was the bigger commodity, they looked at a number of different breeds. It is interesting, the different breeds have provided different fiber diameter of wool, and those different fiber diameters provide for that wool being used for different applications. So a lot of the breeds that were developed and used came from the Sheep Experiment Station in Du Bois, Idaho, which has had over 100-year history now, celebrated its 100th year in 2015. Anyway, they utilized a number of different breeds, but many times the Rambouillet was the base breed in which they developed them from. The Rambouillets, which originated from Rambouillet, France, and were of the Merino descent from the Spanish Merinos, were highly valued because of their fine wool and the fabrics that you could make from that, and also had a number of other attributes, being closer to the equator. Tended to be more of a desert animal as opposed to the English breeds, and also had a longer or more year-round breeding season than the English breeds, and sheep, like deer, are photoperiod sensitive to their breeding times. Anyway, Rambouillets were always popular, but tended to be small, you know, too small a sheep, so they integrated some of the English breeds like the Lincolns into those and crossed them up and created what we know as the Columbia breed. And then utilizing some of the Columbia establishment and some more Rambouillet influence, developed the Targhee breed. And the Sheep Experiment Station is in the Targhee Mountains of Idaho, and hence the name Targhee. So right now, we look at the two big Western ewe breeds are the Targhee and the Rambouillets because of the value of the fine fleeces. The coarse wools that the Columbias had and the Corridales, which were a New Zealand originated breed, those coarse wool fibers, that industry has been taken up by synthetic fibers so much that there just isn't the value in those wools as there is in the finer wools. The finer wools, those fibers, and those fibers are made into fabrics that we look at for finer, higher-ended clothing, like Italian suits. We're very proud of the fact that A lot of our military dress uniforms are made from wool, and that's American wool that they have to source. And those come from the northern plains up here. And now we're seeing a resurgence of those wools being utilized into what we call next-to-skin or base-layer garments that a lot of outdoors people utilize because of some of the processing technologies and the improvements of the uniformity of the fiber. We don't have that itch factor that wool was negatively associated with. If you wore a wool garment, it was really scratchy or itchy. The finer fibers have what we call a higher comfort factor, meaning that they have fewer fibers that are greater than 30 micron. And 30 micron is kind of the number where you start having that prickle factor, itch factor that we start feeling on the human skin. So we see a lot of people utilizing socks and long underwear and long-sleeved and short-sleeved shirts as base layer clothing because of the properties of wool's ability to wick away moisture, keep the skin cool, and also provides that thermal layer to keep people warm. The other way, and then wool also has a natural antimicrobial property to it that keeps the odors from becoming too repulsive.
So when did the lamb meat market take off, and when did that open up and start to be something that people were also paying a lot of more attention to?
Well, it's always been there. It's just so much of our society is ethnically driven, and so you look at, again, who are the major settlers were of European descent, more used to cattle as dual purpose rather than sheep, so you would see some of that, although, England has a lot of breeds of sheep, and even Spain right now has 23 million sheep for their numbers, and that, as compared to 5 million in the United States, is quite a contrast. However, there's always been a market for lamb. It's just that because of the size of the animal and cost to slaughter and process are very similar to beef, you're just getting that much more off of a beef animal in muscle. Material. So, from a packer's point of view, it's a lot easier to produce that meat product using cattle. However, like we've talked, sheep do a very good job of utilizing forages that may be of lower quality and more undesirable. So you're still taking the ability to convert forages into red meat, and sheep, being providing that wool factor, have quite a regenerative story then, in that you're taking those undesirable forages, grazing them, and then converting them into a usable fiber such as wool, really provides a good story for people to hear. Back to your question regarding the meat industry. Sheep numbers in the United States were at their highest and peaked just after World War II. And again, a lot of that was because of the demand for meat and wool for the national defense. And as the synthetic fibers came on and created more competitive edge with wool, you saw some of that value decrease and thus started the decline of the sheep industry just because of the lack of demand for wool. The demand for lamb meat has always stayed about the same, although we're seeing in recent years, as we have more cultural diversity and ethnicity in our country, we're seeing a lot of those folks who have originated from areas of the world that consume lamb and goat have a greater demand and want for those meats. An interesting fact is that 70% of the world's population eats lamb and goat. It's just not us. That makes sense. You start to think about it. Where do you find the concentration of the world's population? And that's along the equator. And what is a lot of that environment like along the equator? Well, it's, a lot of it's desert or at least semi-arid. And so what animals do you find there? Sheep and goats and some cattle. So you can see some of those cultural histories that start to impact just like they have in the development of our countries show up here. So, but, and as we see with the newer generations, after World War II, the old story as it's always gone, a lot of the servicemen that came home, especially that fought and served in the Pacific Theater, ate a lot of what we would call mutton from Australia. In that case, was a lot of old wethers. Australia is still huge in wool production, and at that time raised a lot of wethers for nothing but wool. So the tallow factor, or that off flavor that we can have in lamb or mutton meat due to the fat residue that hadn't been drained away, can be pretty profound, especially in older sheep. So a lot of those servicemen had and did not want anything to do with lamb meat when they returned for a number of reasons. You know, as that generation is passing, the newest generations are more adventure-seeking, both in their food experiences as well as other things, and we're seeing a renewed interest in that eating experience with lamb. And with folks buying good American lamb, they find that there is a very good, enjoyable eating experience with it.
So how do you see the future of this industry, I guess, as we've talked a little bit about the history in the West? What do you see as the future? And then the second question, this is going to be workingcows.net/81. Would you like me to put anything up there or anything you want to share with people as they are just wanting to learn a little bit more?
So some immediate resources that folks can access to find out about the history of the sheep industry in South Dakota is the South Dakota, or SDSU's South Dakota Agricultural Museum on the campus of Brookings. They actually did an exhibit here a couple years ago on the sheep industry in South Dakota and did an excellent job and received several national awards for that display and their investigations and the presentations of those histories. So that's a good place to start. What do we see? The future of the sheep industry has a very unique and great opportunity in the United States, as I see it, from a very sustainable, regenerative application in how we start approaching our new paradigm of what agriculture is. And I'm leading up to soil health and rangeland health, which I really believe is quite a game changer, and we'll be talking about it 40 years from now as folks talk about what the New Deal did in the 40s to and the NRCS, or what at that time was the SCS, did to improve conservation of our natural resources. And having livestock integrated into cropland systems as part of that tool to improve soil health, but also as part of the enterprise return in dollars and cents, I think sheep really have an opportunity to play a role there because you're able to graze some residues with little animal impact on the soil, but at the same time cycle those nutrients. And on my own operation, that's where I'm headed, is to try to get to a point where a person doesn't have to have a lot of dependency on fossil fuels in the forms of diesel or chemical fertilizer. And we know that it's just a matter of time that as those fuel prices go up and supplies become short, that can really hinder our national defense and our national economy. So if we can get agriculture to be better prepared to not be so dependent on those resources and at the same time maintain our food production and fiber production, we have a very good opportunity utilizing sheep to do that.
Very good. Appreciate that a lot. Recently, I had an episode, actually just last week, we had episode 78 with Trent Stout, and we talked about soil health, and he mentioned that he, in Iowa, doesn't know where he would go to find livestock to integrate onto cropland. Do you think that with somebody like that, you're the best person I know to ask this question, so I'm going to ask you, with soil like that, where they've got feet of topsoil, is the depletion more of a risk when they deplete those soil life in something with that much topsoil? Does it take longer to get it back, or do they just have that much more of a buffer? Is that just an asset that they have that they can farm in an extractive way rather than a regenerative way and not have a risk of losing that soil life? Does that make sense?
Yes, it makes absolute sense. I could look like a really good farmer too if I had 26 inches of rainfall every year. it's all a function of moisture, and the semi-arid areas out here where we're at with 15 inches of rainfall, soil health and these practices have made a huge difference in consistency from year to year in production and developing organic matter faster than what they claimed we could do. The folks in those deep topsoils in Minnesota and Iowa have a different situation there. Their organic matters aren't always the challenge. It's their soil function in that a number of things are happening that aren't positive, and one is they're not capturing and holding that chemical fertilizer they're putting in, and then therefore even the chemicals they're using, pesticides, are contaminating the groundwater because they've got those high water tables. Soil health will address a lot of those. You'll stabilize your mineral movements, and you put livestock on there, which that's just a matter of time. If you put money to it, and again, like I said, it doesn't. For most of us, you can think back to 2008 when we were paying $4.28 a gallon for diesel fuel, and that fertilizers were up over $1,000 a ton. That any way you can reduce them, whether that improves your organic matter or not, is going to improve your bottom line. And so, soil health makes sense on so many different levels to ensure a future in agriculture for each individual producer, that you just have to figure out how it's going to best serve you. So I think that's where they're missing out on some of those opportunities. Yeah, it's a want to. You get in a situation where you're needing another enterprise to provide some revenue because the margins on corn aren't there or beans aren't there, and livestock provides this opportunity to graze. And what a neat thing, I think, of grazing on cropland where I'm not concentrating manure in a feedlot. And I don't have to haul that manure out, and I don't have to haul that hay in. And the ammonia is going right into the soil, and the nitrate nitrogen that's coming out in the fecal material is sitting on top with the residue and mixing in. I can't see any better way to do that. That's the way these prairies naturally function, in Iowa included in that, over all those years. It's just that they had the rainfall to grow the tall grasses that created the huge biomasses and the soil functioning that created the topsoils there and the organic bedders that we can, just can't fathom. But it is impressive in the 20 years that I've done some of this, that within the last 5 to 10 where I've really concentrated on the soil health, I've moved more in those 5 years than I did in the first 15 years.
Well, Dave, thanks for your time today. I appreciate the opportunity to sit down and get a little bit of this history on the sheep industry.
You bet. Thank you for having me, Clay.
I've got a really interesting next couple of weeks planned for you guys. Where we're going over the next week is I think I'm going to have a couple of more bonus episodes for you with Arnelles Nash. Interestingly enough, he just passed away this last week, but I was able to sit down with him and record an episode with him on kind of the history of the money and banking and credit system in America. And then there's a pretty tightly tied into that companion episode with L. Carlos Lara about the infinite banking concept, which we've touched on with Mary Jo Ehrman a couple of times with Farming Without the Bank. But we're going to take a real deep dive into that. And I would ask you to look at those opportunities more as almost webinars and classes that you're going to sit down and take notes on, because it's some really incredible stuff and really, I think, some stuff that can prepare you for the future. So I'd ask you to tune in to those bonus episodes. Don't let them pass you by, and take the time to listen to them when you have some time to sit down and take some notes, because those guys are going to really help us out, and really just feel privileged to have been able to sit down and capture Nelson Nash's thoughts for an hour or so before his passing. And I know, you know, given his testimony that he is with Jesus and he's enjoying the presence of the Lord, and that he is has received his blessing for a life lived in devotion to Jesus this side of eternity. But again, just a privilege to be able to share that with you guys. And so just be on the lookout for that over the next couple of weeks, two bonus episodes. And then this main episode that's going to come out next week is an episode with one of the founders of BeefChain, which is a blockchain traceability tool, not a government-mandated traceability tool, but a free market traceability tool for the beef industry that I think has some really, really huge potential for power and really good stuff there. So I would really encourage you to tune in for that episode, and also to tune in for a webinar that we will be announcing in the near future in tandem with that episode. We're gonna schedule a webinar for people to sit down and join and to be walked through BeefChain and how they could implement it on their operation. So I want to do the episode first, and then hopefully we'll drive some interest for that webinar coming up in the near future. So busy couple of weeks here on the Working Cows podcast, and really look forward to serving you with some content that can really be practically inputted into the financial future of your family, and also practically help you with the value proposition that you are sending forward to the next person in the supply chain of your critters. So just make sure you're subscribed at workingcows.net/subscribe so that you're not missing any of these episodes, bonus episodes or otherwise. Some really good stuff from these people that I've had the opportunity to sit down with over the last few weeks. And I would ask you to tune in and to take notes and prepare to join us for that webinar coming up in the near future. So look forward to this next couple of weeks on the Working Cows podcast. Thanks.
We invite you to visit workingcows.net to subscribe to the show via iTunes or Stitcher. You'll also find detailed show notes pages, resources from our guests, and the industry leaders who have influenced them. For more ideas on putting your cows to work for you in a more profitable way, tune in next week.